Remailwith, he said. You're still alive. I'll tell your honoured mother that when next we meet at court.
I'd be most grateful, good sir. But have I had the honour of meeting you? Wretch that I am, I fear me I've forgotten your name.
Oh, I doubt if you ever knew it. It's Cunvelin, and I know your lady mother fairly well.
He considered Rodri shrewdly for a moment.
It truly does gladden my heart to see you alive and well. Doubtless you haven't heard the news from Aberwyn.
None good, sir, except what scraps the occasional traveller gives me.
Ah, well, your brother's second wife appears to be barren, while his cast-off lady was delivered of a fine, healthy son.
Rodri swore under his breath with a most uncourtly oath, but the councillor merely smiled. It was a moment he'd remember all his life, a moment as unlikely as the sun rising suddenly in a midnight sky, changing night magically into day. When Rhys died, he would be Aberwyn's heir, and he allowed himself to hope for the thing that he'd long since given up hoping for, recall. Aberwyn was such an important ran that the king himself might well take a hand in bringing home its heir from the dangers of the long road.
I would advise you to keep yourself as safe as possible, Cunvelin said. Are you short up for coin?
Not in the least.
Good. Perhaps then you can avoid hiring out your sword straight away.
I will, good sir.
Although Rodri's heart ached to ask more, he knew that the old man's court training would allow no more answers. For a few moments they rode in silence, then Cunvelin turned to him.
Your little daughter's well, by the by. Your lady mother keeps her always by her side.
Rodri had to think for a moment before he remembered the bastard he'd sired on a common-born lass.
How many years ago was it? He wondered. 3, I think. That's most kind of my lady mother, he said hurriedly. And what is she named?
Rother, to keep her father's memory alive.
I see. Mother always did know how to badger Rhys.
The councillor allowed himself the briefest of smiles. Rodri spent the rest of the journey in a fury of impatience to tell Jill the councillor's news. If he were reading the hints aright, soon they would be back in Eldith, living in the comfort and splendour he assumed that she wanted. And this time, she would be more than just his mistress. He was no longer a spoiled younger son who needed a strong wife to keep him in rein. He was a man they needed, a man in a position to make demands. He would get her a title, settle land upon her as a dower gift, and marry her, no matter what his mother and the king thought of it. Late on a splendid sunny day, the herald and his escort rode up to Greymon's Dun. As they clattered through the gates, Rodri was looking around for Jill. The ward was full of riders, standing in a reasonable excuse for a formation, while the two tyrants stood at the door of the Brock to greet their honoured guest. In the confusion, he saw no sign of her, nor did she come to meet him while he stabled his horse and Neth's. Although he was rather hurt, he thought little of it, assuming that Lady Camer had kept her at her side for some reason, until Neth came hurrying into the stable.
"My lord," Rodri said, "is Jill in the Great Hall?"
"She's not. Is Perrin in here?"
"He's not. Isn't he with the other noble-born?"
Neth went a little pale about the mouth.
"Oh, by the black balls of the Lord of Hell!" Neth snarled. "He wouldn't have. The rotten little weasel. Oh, curse him for a pig's ballock."
"My lord, what is all this? I don't know yet. Come with me."
Rodri tagged after as Ned searched the great hall for Camer, finally finding her as she gave orders to the servants about the feast to come. When Ned caught her arm, she saw Rodri and gasped, a little puff of breath.
"Oh, by the gods," she said. "But you've got to know, and it best be sooner than later, I suppose. Nez, if I ever get my hands on your misbegotten wretch of a cousin, I'll beat him black and blue."
"I'll hold him down while you do it. What's he done with Jill?"
Camer laid a maternal hand on Rodri's arm, her large dark eyes full of sincere apology.
"Rodri, your Jill's gone. All I can think is that she rode off with Perrin, because he disappeared not an hour after she did. My heart truly aches for you."
Rodri opened his mouth and shut it again, then clasped his sword hilt so hard that the leather bindings bit into his palm. Neth had gone dead white.
"Did you know summat about this?"
Rodri growled.
Well, not truly. I mean, ye gods, I knew he fancied your lass, but I never thought anything would come of it.
With a great effort of will, Rodri reminded himself that it would be dishonourable to kill him in front of a lady. Kama gave his arm a little shake.
Oh, come now, she said. Who in their right mind would ever have thought that Jill would leave a man like you for one like Perrin?
His pride was sopped just enough to make him let go the hilt.
Now here, Ned said to the lady, did my uncle know of this? I can't believe he'd let Perro do such a dishonourable thing.
And why do you think your wretched cousin slipped out like a weasel? Benwick chased him with some of his men, but Perrin went off through the forest. They never found a trace of him.
Ned started to answer, then simply stared at Rodri. They were in a terrible position, and they both knew it. If Rodri swore bloody vengeance where the Lord could hear, he would be honour-bound to stop Rodri from riding, if he could. The fear in Ned's eyes was satisfying to see.
Now here, came Benwick's bellow. What's all this?
Hands on hips, the tyrant strode over and shoved himself between them.
I take it Rodri's found out the truth.
He has,
Kama said.
Now listen, Ned. Your worm-riddled cousin's in the wrong, and you know it as well as I do. On the other hand, Silver Dagger, she wasn't legally your wife, so you've no right to kill him. Beat him black and blue, decidedly, but not to kill him. Will you make me a solemn oath that you won't kill or maim him? If you do, you ride out of here with my blessing and a bit of extra coin. If you won't, then you're not leaving at all.
Rodri glanced around at the hall, filled with armed men.
Now, come to your senses, lad,
Benwick went on.
I know cursed well that the first thing a man thinks of in times like this is spilling blood. But ask yourself this. If you cut your Jill's throat, wouldn't you be weeping over her not 5 minutes later?
Well, Your Grace, I would.
Good. I feel the shame my nephew laid upon his clan. Do you want her back or not? If not, then I'll pay you a bride price, just as if she'd been your wife. If you do, then swear me that vow and ride with my aid.
Faced with this scrupulous fairness, Rodri felt his rage slip away. In its place came a cold realization that nearly made him weep. Jill didn't love him any more.
Well, Your Grace, call me a fool if you want, but I do want her back. I've got a thing or two to say to her, and by every god in the other lands, I'll find her if I search all summer long.
This is a bit of luck, Merrick said.
Well, in a way, Gwyn said. We won't have to bother with the lass, sure enough, but Rodri's going to be following her, not moving in the direction we want him to.
Oh, indeed. Think, young one. From everything I've been able to see, this Perrin fellow knows the woods like his mother's tit. What does a man like Rodri know of woodcraft? When he was a lord, he had foresters and game wardens to worry about such things, and silver daggers stick to the roads.
He smiled gently.
I'll talk to Brithin through the fire about this, but I think we've found the perfect bait to lure our bird down to the sea coast. The only clues he'll find are the ones we throw in his path.
2. All summer long, Salamander, or Ebani Salamanderiel, to give him his full elvish name, had been riding through Deveri and tracking his brother down. But he'd done it slowly, by a long winding road, because the people never hurried anywhere, and for all his human blood, he'd been raised among the elves. Right at first, just over the Eldith border, he'd found a pretty lass who'd taken to more than his songs. He idled in Cairn Metin with her for a pair of pleasant weeks. Then, once he was up in Pirden, a noble lord paid him well for entertaining the guests at his daughter's wedding. 6 merry days of feasting. After that, he wandered through Deveri, always heading north to Caer Gonni, but sometimes lingering in an interesting town for a few days here. A lord's done for an 8-night there. When he'd scried Rodri out and find him besieged, he'd put on a good burst of speed, but only until he saw the siege lifted. Then it had seemed that his brother would be perfectly safe for a good long time, so he dallied again with another lass who'd been faithfully waiting for him since the summer before. It had seemed terribly dishonourable, after all, to just ride out quickly after she waited for such a long time. And so it was that he was some 100 miles to the east of Greymans Dun on the sunny afternoon when Rodri escorted the herald and the councillor there. He'd made an early camp by a stream, early simply because he was tired of riding, and tethered his horses out in a tiny meadow before he went down to the running water to scry. He saw Rodri trembling as Camma told him her news, and with so much emotion behind it, the vision was strong enough so that he actually could hear, though not with his physical ears, something of what was said. It seemed indeed that he stood beside his brother as Benoit took the matter in hand. Then the vision vanished abruptly, banished by his own flood of feeling. He leapt to his feet and swore aloud.
"By the gods!"
He shook his head in amazement. "Whoever would have thought it, indeed! I can't believe Joe would desert him. I quite simply can't." Kneeling again, he stared at the sun-dancing water and thought of Jill. Her image built up slowly, and when it came it was oddly wavering and blurred. She was sitting in a mountain meadow and watching while Perrin tethered out 3 horses, including her Sunrise. His first thought was that she was ill because she sat so quietly, her mouth slack like a half-wit's, yet it was hard to see because the vision was so misty. With a toss of his head, he dismissed it.
"No, this looks most dire, peculiar and puzzling. I think me I'd best try for a better look."
When he called aloud in Elvish for wild folk, 4 gnomes and a sylph materialized in front of him.
"Listen carefully, little brothers. I've got a task for you, and if you do it, I'll sing you a song when you're done. I want to go to sleep, and I want you to stand here and watch for danger. If any one or any animal comes toward me, pinch me and wake me up."
The gnomes nodded solemnly, while the sylph dipped and hovered in the air. Salamander lay down on his back, crossed his arms over his chest, and slowed his breathing until he felt that his body was melding with the sun-warmed earth. Then he closed his eyes and summoned his body of light. Unlike human Dwayoma masters, who use a solid bluish form shaped like their own body, the elven thought form is much like an enormous flickering flame, yet with an ever-shifting face peering out of the silver light. Once Salamander's form lived steady in his imagination, he transferred his consciousness over to it, at first only pretending to look out of its eyes at his body lying below, then seeing the world in the bluish, etheric light. He heard a sound like a sharp click. He was out on the etheric plane, looking down from the flame shape at his sleeping body, guarded by the wild folk, and joined to him by a long silver cord. Slowly he rose up, orienting himself to the valleys, bright red and glowing with the dull auras of plants, and to the stream, which exhaled elemental force in a rushy silver curtain that rose high above the water. Getting entangled in that curtain could tear him apart. Carefully he moved away from it before going higher, then thought of Jill. He felt a certain tug pulling him in her direction and set off to follow it. For a long ways, impossible to measure on the etheric, he sped over the dull red forests, broken here and there by brighter patches of farmlands, tended by the peasants, whose auras gleamed around them, pale yellows and greens mostly, in the bluish light of the plain. As he travelled, he became more and more aware of Jill's presence, pulling him forward. Yet in the end, he had a guide. He had just flown high over a small stream when he saw one of the wild folk coming toward him. In its proper sphere, the creature was a beautiful nexus of glowing lines and colours, a deep olive, citrine and russet, with a spark here and there of black, but it was obviously in distress, swelling up twice its size, then shrinking and trembling.
"Hear, hear, little brother," Salamander thought to it. "What's so wrong?"
For an answer it spun and danced, but dimly he could feel its emotions, rage and despair for something it loved. He remembered then Jill's grey gnome.
"Do you know Jill?"
It bobbed and swelled with joy.
"I'm her friend. Take me to her."
The gnome swept on ahead of him like a hunting dog. As he flew after, dodging round the curves of a hill, Salamander saw far below him the mountain valley, a red glowing bowl of grass, dotted with the dim silvery auras of the horses, and two human auras, Perrin's a strange green and grey that Salamander had never seen before, Jill's pale gold, but enormous, swelling up around her, sending off billows, then shrinking again, but to a size far too large for any human being. When he dropped down toward her, he saw Perrin turn and say something. From the young lord's aura came a light-shot surge, spilling over Jill like an ocean wave. In response, her aura billowed and sucked the magnetic effluent up. Salamander hovered, trembling with shock. At that moment, Jill looked up, straight at him, and screamed aloud. She had seen his body of light.
"Jill, I'm a friend!"
Yet although she could see him, she couldn't seem to hear his thought. She flung herself to her feet and pointed at him, yelling all the while at Perrin, who merely looked puzzled. Salamander swooped away, following the silver cord as fast as he dared back to his body, which lay safely where he'd left it, with the wild folk still on guard. He swooped down until he hovered over it, then let himself go. Again, the click, and he felt flesh wrap him round, warm and painfully heavy for a moment. He dismissed his body of light, then sat up, slapping his hand thrice on the ground to seal the end of the working. The gnomes looked at him expectantly.
"My thanks, my friends. Come travel along with me for a while. I'll sing you the song I promised, but I've got to make speed. A good friend of mine has been well and truly ensorcelled."
In a flood of silver light, the dawn climbed up purple mountains and washed over the meadow, a green torrent of grass that swirled in the summer wind. Jill sat on their blankets and watched Perrin, crouched down by the fire, where he was heating water in a little iron kettle. He took his razor, a bit of soap, and a cracked mirror out of his saddlebags and began to shave, as calmly and efficiently as if he were in a bedchamber. Jill had a vague thought of slitting his throat with the long, sharp steel razor, or perhaps her silver dagger, but thinking was very difficult.
"You best eat summat," he remarked.
"In a bit."
Speaking was difficult too.
"I'm not truly hungry."
Idly she looked away, only to see her grey gnome, hunkered down some yards beyond Perrin. She was so glad to see the little creature that she jumped up and ran over. But just as she bent down to pick it up, it snarled, swiped at her with its claws, and vanished. Very slowly she sat down right where she was, wondering why the gnome was so angry at her. It seemed that she should know, but the memory wouldn't return. She picked up a pebble from the grass and stared at it, a constant wavering flow of crystalline structure made visible, until Perrin came to fetch her away. All that morning they rode through the forest, following long, roundabout trails. Every tree was a living presence, leaning over the trail and reaching down to her with brushy fingers. Some frightened her, others seemed perfectly harmless. Still others, a definite few, seemed to be asking her to befriend them with a trembling outreach of leafy hands. When she looked away from the trail, the forest changed into a maze of solid walls, broken only by shafts of sunlight as heavy as stone. Although at times Jill considered simply riding away from Perrin, she was hopelessly lost. Every now and then she thought of Rodri and wondered if he was trying to follow them. She doubted that he'd believe her when she told him that she hadn't ridden away of her own free will. If indeed he ever caught them, how could he find her? When the whole world had changed. Every colour, even the sombre grey of the rocks, seemed as bright and glowing as a jewel. Whenever they came to a clearing or a mountain meadow, the sun poured over her like water. She could swear that she felt it dripping and running down her arms. The sky was a solid dome of lapis lazuli, and for the first time in her life, she truly believed that the gods travelled across the sky the way we travel across the earth, just because the colour truly did seem to fit for divinities. Under the heavy burden of all this beauty, she felt as if she were reeling in her saddle, and at times tears ran down her face, just from the loveliness. Once, as they rode through a meadow, a pair of larks broke cover and flew, singing their heartbreaking trill as they went up and up into the azure crystalline sky, their wings rushing and beating in a tiny thunder. Jill saw then that whatever else might happen, that moment, that beating of wings, that stripe of sound would all endure eternally, as indeed would every moment, a clear note in the unfolding music of the universe. When she tried to tell Perrin of the insight, he only stared at her and told her she was daft. She laughed, agreeing with him. That afternoon they camped early near a good-sized stream. Perrin took a line and hook from his gear, remarked that he was after fish, and wandered away upstream. For a long time Jill lay on the bank and stared into the water, watching the wild folk in the eddies, a white foam of little faces, traces of sleek bodies, little voices and lives, melding and blending into each other. It seemed that there was something that they wanted of her, and finally she stripped off her clothes and joined them. Giggling, laughing, she ducked and splashed in the water with the Undines, tried to catch them as they swam away from her, and for the first time she heard them clearly, giggling in return, calling out her name, Jill, 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 over and over again. Then suddenly they shrieked and disappeared. Jill turned in the water and looked up to see Perrin, standing on the bank with a string of 3 trout in one hand. Her heart sank, just as when a pupil looks up from a game to find her tutor glaring with a piece of unfinished work in his hand. Yet when she clambered up onto the bank, he was far from angry with her, catching her, kissing her, wrapping her round with his desire until she wanted him too, and lay down willingly with him in the grass. Afterward, he got up, dressed, and methodically began cleaning the fish. But she lay naked in the soft grass and tried to remember the name of the man she once had loved and who, or so she suspected, still loved her. Although she could see his face in her mind, her memory refused to give up his name. Puzzling over it, she got up and dressed, then chanced to look down at the stream. The wild folk were back, staring at her reproachfully.
"Rodri, Jill," they whispered. "How could you have forgotten your Rodri?"
She doubled over and wept, sobbing aloud. When Perrin came rushing to comfort her, she shoved him away so hard that he tripped and fell. Like a frightened animal she ran, racing through the long grass of the clearing, plunging into the forest, only to catch an ankle on a root and sprawl headlong. For a moment she lay there, panting, seeing how dark the trees were, how menacingly they reached down to grab her. Now they looked like a line of armed guards, raising weapons high. When he came to fetch her back, she went without arguing. That evening he built a fire and skewered the trout on green sticks to roast them. Jill ate a few bites, but the food seemed to stick in her mouth, the fish suddenly as cloying as pure honey. Perrin, however, wolfed down his share as if he were starving, then fell asleep by the fire. She watched him for a long time. Although it would have been ridiculously easy to kill him, the memory of the forest stopped her. If he died, she would be alone, trapped out there, starving, wandering in circles, growing more and more panicked. With the last of her will, she wrenched her mind away from the thoughts that were threatening to turn her hysterical. Shaking, suddenly cold, she stared into the fire, where the spirits were forming and falling in the flames, dancing along the wood that this pair of humans had so thoughtfully provided. Jill could almost hear them talking in the hiss and crackle. Then a log burned through and fell with a shower of golden sparks. In the rushy dance of flame, a proper face appeared, golden and shifting. When it spoke, it was in a true voice, and one with authority.
"What is this, child? What's so wrong?"
"Wrong?"
she could barely stammer.
"Is it?"
For a moment the face regarded her, then it was gone. Somewhat bewildered, unable to think, Jill lay down next to Perrin and fell asleep. As formless as water, the days slipped into one another. Jill couldn't count them. She'd lost the very idea of counting, as if the part of her mind that dealt with things like knights and coins had fallen out of her saddlebags and gotten lost in the grass. Whenever he spoke to her, it was hard to answer, because her words became lost in the splendour of the forest. Fortunately, he rarely spoke, apparently contented with her silent presence near him. At night, when they made camp, he was an eager lover, wanting her in their blankets often before they'd eaten, then bringing her dinner like a page as she lay drowsily by the fire. His slow hesitance, his shuffling walk, his vague smiles and stumbling words, all were gone. He was all laughter and calm efficiency, all strength and life as he strode through the wild country. She supposed that his daft mousiness was simply a shield he put up when he was forced to live in the lands of men. She was proven right when they rode into a village to buy food at the open market. Perrin became his old self, looking aimlessly this way and that, stumbling through every simple sentence as he haggled for cheese and peaches, for loaves of bread from the baker. Since Jill could speak no more clearly than he could, she was of no help to him. Once she saw a farmer's wife watching them in puzzlement, as if she were wondering how a pair of half-wits like they could survive on the road. With the shopping done, they went to a tiny tavern for ale. After nothing but spring water to drink, the ale tasted so good that Jill savoured every sip. Although the little room had dirty straw on the floor, an unswept hearth and battered tables, she was happy there. It was good to see other people, her own kind, good to listen to human voices instead of the endless wind through the forest and the chatter of streams. A balding stout fellow, wearing the checked brigger of a merchant, gave her a friendly smile.
"Here, lass," he said, "why do you carry a silver dagger?"
Oh, well, Jill said, "my father was a silver dagger, you see. It's a reminder of him."
A pious gesture, truly.
Jill had the suddenly startling experience of hearing him think.
A pretty lass, but stupid. Ah, well, wits don't matter in a lass.
The thought was as clear in her mind as if he'd spoken aloud, but she decided that she was only deluding herself. When it was time to leave the tavern, she wept, simply because they were going back to the lonely wilderness. That afternoon they rode through low rolling hills, where the pine forest thinned and farms appeared in sheltered valleys. Jill had no idea of where they were. All she knew was that the sun rose in the east and set in the west. They made camp, however, in a place Perrin knew well, or so he said, a tiny vale along a stream and bordered with white birches. Before he lit the fire, he gave Jill a kiss.
"Let's lie down," he said.
All at once the thought of making love with him filled her with revulsion. When she shoved him away, he caught her by the shoulders and pulled her to him. Although she tried to wrestle free, his superior strength told against her. He grabbed her, lifted her, and laid her struggling on the ground. She fought against him, but even as she did, she knew that she was slowly, inexorably giving in to him, fighting with only half her strength, letting him steal a kiss here and there, then a caress, then finally surrendering, letting him take her, press her down, and turn her world to a fire of pleasure. When he lay down next to her, he started to speak, then fell asleep in open-mouthed exhaustion. Jill lay next to him and watched the sunset coming through the branches like a shower of gold coins. The white birches glowed with an inner fire, as if they were watching them and blessing them in silent presences. She could hear the stream running nearby in little voices, the aimless chatter of the wild folk. Just as the sunset was fading into twilight, Perrin sat up with a yawn and a gasp. She saw dark circles under his eyes, two livid pools of shadow. For a moment he stared at her, as if he hardly knew where they were.
"Are you all right?" Jill said.
Oh, well, just tired.
Yet as the evening wore on, she realized that things went far beyond his being tired. When they ate, he gobbled the food, then fell asleep again. She sat by the fire and watched the birches glowing, bending close, it seemed, to study this pair of intruders in the grove. For one moment she thought she saw someone standing among the trees and watching her, but when she got up for a closer look, the shadowy form disappeared. In a bit, Perrin woke again and stumbled over to the fire. A leap of flame washed his face with light and seemed to cover it with blood. His eyes seemed great hollow rents in a mask. Jill cried out at the sight.
"What's wrong?" he said.
Yet she had no words to tell him what she instinctively knew. that their afternoon's lovemaking had driven them to a crisis point, just as when a warrior rides a charge, thinking of naught but the flash of steel around him, only to find himself behind the enemy line, cut off and alone, when it's too late to ride back. When he left Greymon's Dun, Rodri had no idea of which way to ride. For the first day he went west, but at sunset the grey gnome appeared at his camp and threw itself into his arms to cling to him like a frightened child.
"There you are. Here, my friend, where's Jill?"
The gnome considered, pointed east, then disappeared.
"I've wasted a whole blasted day," he thought.
Then, even in the midst of his despair, he felt that strange sensation of being watched. For 3 days more he rode east. He felt more like a storm than a man, his rage and desperation mingling to drive his mind this way and that, tearing his reason to shreds as he swept down the forest road. At times he wanted to find her only to slit her throat. At others he swore to himself that if only he could have her back, he would never ask a single question about what she'd done with Perrin. Gradually he felt more hopelessness than rage. Perrin could have taken her any way at all, slipping deep into the forest where he'd never find them. His one hope was the gnome, who came to him at odd moments. Always it pointed east, and it was filled with fury, gnashing its teeth and clutching its head at any mention of Perrin. Sooner or later, or so Rodri hoped, it would lead him back to Jill. Late on a day when white clouds piled in the sky and threatened rain, Rodri was riding along a narrow track when he came to a clearing. Beside the road was a small wooden roundhouse with two oaks growing in front of the door. He dismounted, led his horse over, and called out a halloo. In a few moments, an aged man with a shaved head and golden talk of a priest of Bel came out.
"Good morrow, Your Holiness," Rodri said.
"May the gods bless you, lad. What troubles your heart so badly?"
"Oh, by the hells, do I look as wretched as that?"
The priest merely smiled, his dark eyes nearly lost in wrinkled folds of pouched eyelids. He was as thin as a stick, his ragged tunic hanging loose, his fingers like gnarled twigs.
"I'm looking for someone, you see," Rodri went on, "and I'm about giving up hope of ever finding her. A blonde lass, beautiful, but she always dresses like a lad and she carries a silver dagger. She'd be riding with a skinny, red-haired fellow."
"Your wife left you for another man?"
"Well, she did, but how did you know?"
"It's a common enough tale, lad, though I've no doubt it pains you as if you were the first man ever deserted by a woman."
He sighed with a shake of his head.
"I haven't seen her, but come in and ask the gods to help you."
More to please the lonely old hermit than in any real hope of getting an omen, Rodri followed him into the dim, musty-smelling shrine, which took up half the roundhouse. On the flat side stood the stone altar, covered with a rough linen cloth to hide the bloodstains from the sacrifices. Behind it rose a massive statue of Bel, carved from a tree trunk, the body roughly shaped, the arms distinguished by mere cuts in the wood, and the tunic indicated only by scratches. The face, however, was beautifully modelled, large eyes staring out as if they saw, the mouth so mobile it seemed that it would speak. Rodri made a formal bow to the King of the World, then knelt before him while the priest stood to one side. In the shadowy light, it seemed that the god's eyes turned his worshipper's way.
"O most holy lord, where's my Jill? Will I ever see her again?"
For a moment silence lay thick in the temple. Then the priest spoke in a hollow, booming voice, utterly unlike his normal tone.
"She rides down dark roads. Judge her not harshly when you meet again. One who holds no fealty to me holds her in thrall."
Rodri felt a cold shudder of awe, laced with fear. The god's eyes considered him, and the voice spoke again.
"You have a strange weird, man from Eldith, you who are not truly a man like other men. Some day you'll die serving the kingdom, but it's not the death you would ever have dreamt for yourself. Men will remember your name down the long years, though your blood run over rock and be gone. Truly, they'll remember it twice over, for twice over will you die."
Suddenly the priest threw up his hands and clapped them together hard. Dazed, Rodri looked around. The statue was only a piece of wood, cleverly carved. The god had gone. All that day, while he travelled fast along, Rodri puzzled over the omen. What did it mean, that Jill rode down dark roads? He desperately wanted it to mean that Perrin had somehow forced her to come with him, rather than her going willingly. But it was hard to convince himself of that, because Jill could have slain the Lord easily if he had tried violence. Still, he clung to the first bit of hope he had that she still loved him. His heart was so torn for love of and fear for her that he never remembered the rest of the omen until years later, that, contrary to all nature and all sense, he would die twice over. On the morrow, the meaning of the part of the omen that dealt with Jill came clearer when he reached a small village. In the tiny tavern, he got his first hot meal and tankard of ale in days. As he was eating mutton stew by the unswept hearth, the tavernman strolled over to gossip.
"You're the second silver dagger we've seen in here lately," he said. "Oh, well, I don't suppose this lass was truly a silver dagger."
"A blonde lass." Rodri's heart was pounding even as he spoke casually. "Beautiful, but dressed like a lad."
"Just that. Do you know her?"
"I do. How long ago was she and her red-haired lad in here? I'd like to see Jill and Perrin again." The tavernman considered, scratching his bald spot.
"Not more than 4 nights ago, I'd say. Friends of yours, are they? Neither of them are much for words, I must say."
"Oh, Perrin never says much, truly." Rodri tried to sound cheerfully friendly.
"But usually his lass is good for a bit of chatter." "Indeed. Then she must be ill or such like, because it was hard for her to say 2 words together. One of those thick-headed lasses, think I, all pretty face with nothing between her 2 ears. Here, I hope she wasn't ill. She's usually as bright as a lark and twice as merry."
The tavernman considered a long moment.
"Well, maybe she and that man of hers had a bit of a scrap. From the way she looked at him, I'd say he beats her a good bit. Fair terrified she looked."
Rodri's hand tightened on the tankard so hard that his knuckles went white.
"Riding down dark roads," he thought. "I see." "Be that as it may, lad, they went south when they left here. She said she was riding south to find her grandfather."
For a moment, Rodri was puzzled.
"Nevin," he thought. "Of course, that's how she'd describe him." "Well and good, then, and my thanks."
He tossed the man a piece of Benoic silver. Leaving the tankard unfinished, Rodri rode out fast, heading for the crossroads and the track that would take him south. The tavernman watched, rubbing Rodri's coin until the silver dagger was out of sight. All at once he felt both guilty and frightened. Why had he lied like that, and all for the couple of coins that the strange fellow had given him? He hated to lie. Dimly he remembered arguing with the fellow, but here, after all he'd said, he'd gone and done it. He wished he had a horse, so that he could ride after the silver dagger and tell him the truth. He shook himself and looked up. The village idiot, poor old Marrow, was shuffling along the street. The tavernman flung him Rodri's coin.
"Here, lad, take that home to your mother and tell her I said she's to buy you cloth for a new shirt."
Grinning from ear to ear, Marrow ran off. The tavernman went back to his customers.
"South," Salamander said aloud. "How by every boil on the Lord of Hell's balls did Rodri know to turn south?"
The wild folk clustered around his campfire seemed to be pondering the question.
"My apologies, little brothers. Just a rhetorical question."
Stretching, Salamander got up and frowned at the night sky while he wished he'd scried Rodri out earlier. Since he was not much more than an apprentice at Dwayoma, it was difficult for him to scry without a focus of some sort, and impossible when he was occupied with something else, such as riding horseback. As he thought about it, he supposed that Rodri was riding south out of a simple desperation that had brought him a silver dagger's luck. Without Dwayoma, he himself would never have been able to track Jill down, because that strange man of hers knew the woods as well as wild deer did. As it was, of course, he knew exactly where they were, just 10 miles to the northeast of him, so that indeed Rodri was to the north of them and on the right road by heading south. The question was, how did Rodri know it?
"Tomorrow, little brothers, tomorrow we track this bear to his den."
In unease, the wild folk rustled around him, shoving and pinching each other, opening their mouths in gaping expressions of despair and hatred. Salamander shuddered in honest fear. For all he knew, the man that had stolen Jill was a Dwayoma master of great power, and he was riding to his doom.
"You know, I suppose I really should contact Nevin and tell him about all this."
The wild folk all nodded a vigorous yes.
"But on the other hand, suppose I do, and he tells me that I should leave this nasty mess strictly alone. How then could I redeem myself from my dilatory ways this summer? I think me I'd best just continue on."
The wild folk threw their hands in the air, stuck out their tongues at him, and disappeared in a wave of pure disgust. In the morning, the dark circles under Perrin's eyes looked as purple as fresh bruises against his unnaturally pale skin. His red hair no longer flamed, rather it was as dull and matted as the fur of a sick cat. He worked slowly, taking things out of his saddlebags, staring at them for a moment, then putting them back while Jill sat nearby and watched him.
"You truly do look ill," she said.
"Just tired."
She wondered why she cared if he were ill or not, but in truth she was coming to see him as much a victim of his strange powers as she was. The thought came to her only intermittently, however. Thoughts of any sort were rare these days. The pieces of gear in Perrin's hands seemed to be changing size constantly, sometimes swelling, sometimes shrinking, and they had no edges in any proper sense, just lines of shimmering force that marked where they met the air. Finally, he pulled out a plain rod of iron, about a finger thick, set in a wooden handle.
"Thank every god," he said. "Here, I thought I'd lost it."
"What is it?"
"A rambling scribe. Never tell anyone I've got one, will you? You can get hanged for carrying one in Kergoni."
None of this made any sense at all. She forced herself to pick it apart, a little at a time.
"We're still in Kergoni?"
she asked at last.
"We are, but in the southern part, nearly to Gwentea."
"Oh, and what's that thing for?"
"Changing a horse's brand."
"And why will they hang you for having one?"
"Because only a horse thief would carry one."
"Then why are you carrying one?"
"Because I'm a horse thief."
Jill stared open-mouthed at him.
"Where do you think I get the coin we've been spending?"
He was grinning in amusement.
"I take a horse from some noble lord, sell it to one of the men I know, and well, there we are."
Somewhere, deep in her mind, Jill remembered that thievery was a wrong thing. She thought about it while she watched him repack the saddlebags. Thieving was wrong, and being a horse thief was the worst of all. If you took a man's horse, he could die out in the wilderness. Dar always said so. Dar was always right.
"You shouldn't take horses," she said.
"Oh, I only take them from men who can afford the loss."
"It's still wrong."
"Why? I need them and they don't."
Although she knew that there was a counter to this argument, she couldn't remember it. She leaned back and watched the sylphs playing in the light breeze, winged forms of brilliant crystal, darting and dodging after each other in long swoops and glides.
"I'll be leaving you here later," Perrin said in a moment. "We're low on coin, and I've got to take a horse."
"You will come back, won't you?"
Suddenly she was terrified, sure that she would be hopelessly lost without him.
"You won't just leave me here?"
"What? Of course not. I love you more than I love my life. I'll never leave you."
He drew her into his arms and kissed her, then held her close. She was unsure of how long they sat together in the warm sun, but when he let her go, the sun was close to zenith. She wandered over the stream and lay down to watch the wild folk sporting there until she fell asleep. Late that same afternoon, Rodri came to Lerin, one of the biggest towns in Caer Gonny, with about 500 houses huddled behind a low stone wall on the banks of the Cayman Irain. Since Lerin was an important port for the river barges that brought the mountain iron down into Devery, he was planning on buying a passage downriver for a ways to save himself some time and to give himself and his horse a much-needed rest. First, though, he went to the market square and asked around about Jill and Perrin. Quite a few of the locals knew the eccentric Lord Perrin well.
"He's daft," said the cheese seller. "And if that lass is riding with the likes of him, she's even dafter than he."
"A bit more than daft he is," snorted the blacksmith. "I've wondered many a time where he gets all those horses."
"Ah, he's noble-born," chimed in the cloth merchant. "The noble-born have horses to spare, they do. But I haven't seen him in many a long week now, Silver Dagger, and I've never seen a lass like you described."
"No more have I," said the cheese seller. "She sounds a bit of a hard case, she does."
As he went back to the cheap tavern he'd marked earlier, Rodri was wondering if Jill and Perrin had taken a different road south. If so, he'd have to abandon his plans for the river in case he passed them by. As he was stabling his horse, a fellow came out to join him, a rather nondescript man with the bent back of a wandering peddler.
"You the Silver Dagger who was asking for Lord Perrin?"
"I am. And what's it to you?" Rodri asked.
"Not, but I might have a bit of information for you for the right price."
Rodri took two silver pieces from his pouch and held them between his fingers. The peddler grinned.
"I stayed one night in a little village inn, some 30 miles from here. I was trying to get my sleep when I heard someone yelling out in the stable yard. So I sticks my head out the window, and I see our Perrin arguing with this blonde lass. Seems like she was leaving him, and he was yelling at her not to go."
Rodri handed over the first silver.
"I'm going to find no one, she says," the peddler went on. "Seemed like a cursed strange thing to say, so it stuck in my mind like."
"So it would. Did she say where Nevin was?"
"Not truly, but she did say to his lordship that if he tried to follow her to Caermore, she'd take his balls off with her silver dagger."
With a laugh, Rodri handed him the second coin, then dug out a third for good measure.
"My thanks, peddler, and it gladdens my wretched heart that you lost that hour's sleep."
When Rodri left the stable, Merrick laughed quietly under his breath. It was a good jest to make the Silver Dagger pay for the false rumours that were going to mean his doom. Jill woke suddenly at the sound of horses coming. She sat up, wondering why she hadn't tried to escape before Perrin returned. Now it was too late. She stood up, very slowly, because the ground seemed unsteady under her feet. As she walked back to camp, the grass swelled and billowed, as if she trod on a huge feather mattress.
"Jill! Fear not! Rescue is at hand, though truly as a shining avenger one could want better than I."
Startled, she spun around and stared open-mouthed at the man dismounting from his horse on the other side of the clearing. For a moment she thought he was Rodri, but the voice and the pale hair were all wrong. Then she remembered him.
"Salamander! Oh, ye gods!"
Suddenly she was weeping, doubling over as she sobbed, throwing herself from side to side until he ran over and grabbed her tight.
"West, west, little one. All's well, more or less, anyway. You've been ensorcelled, but it's over now."
The tears stopped and she looked up at him.
"It was true, then. He has the Dwayoma."
"I'm not so sure of that, but you were ensorcelled well and truly. Where is he?"
"Off stealing a horse from someone."
"And the horse dung too, no doubt. This lad sounds stranger and stranger."
"You might well say that, and twice. Please, we've got to get away before he gets back."
"Not that, because I've got a thing or two to say to him."
"But he's Dwayoma."
Salamander smiled lazily.
"It is time for all truths to be known. So am I."
She pulled away, staring at him.
"How else did I know you'd been ensorcelled, and how else would I have found you? Now come along, let's get your gear on your horse. I want to curse this fellow to the three hells, and then we've got to be on our way. Rodri's got a long head start on us."
At the mention of Rodri's name, she began to sob again. Salamander pulled her close into his arms.
Nah, little one. Remember, you're a warrior's daughter. There'll be time enough for tears later, when we're well away from here. We'll find your Rodri for you.
Oh, ye gods! I don't know if your brother will even want me back.
Here?
How did you find out?
The urgency in his voice stopped her tears.
I had a true dream. I saw your father.
Gods, if you have that kind of power, and this fellow still... Well, he may be a bit more powerful than I thought, but cursed if I'll run until I get a look at him. Let me saddle your horse for you, and you tell me the tale. As best she could, Jill told him about Perrin and the events of the last few days, but it was difficult for her to find words to put things in any sort of order, or indeed to remember exactly how long she'd been travelling with Perrin. At times it seemed a few years, at others months. She was shocked when Salamander told her that it had been at most a fortnight. While he listened, he grew angry, until finally he cut short one last stumbling sentence with a wave of his hand.
"I've heard enough, little one. This ugly bastard should be flogged and hanged, if you ask me. I wonder if I can get him to a lord's justice."
"Not here. All the lords are his kin."
"And who will believe me when I come to them talking of Dweilmer? Well, there's other kinds of justice in the kingdom."
When she looked at him, she saw his anger like ghostly flames burning over his face and looked away again, yet the vision jogged her memory.
"Was it you I saw a while back? I saw an elf all covered with silver fire in the sky."
"It was, true enough, but you were seeing only a, well, call it an image of me."
She nodded, the thought and the memory slipping away again. She wondered why he was so angry with Perrin, but it seemed that somehow she should know the answer. Salamander was just finishing tying her bedroll behind the saddle when he paused, cocking his head to listen. It was several minutes before she heard the sound of hoofbeats, three horses coming fast. Ducking and dodging among the trees, Perrin rode up with two chestnut colts following him along. As Salamander walked to meet him, Perrin dismounted and ran the last few yards.
"Who are you?" Perrin shouted. "Jill, what are you doing?"
Although she was shaking too hard to speak, her saddled and loaded horse was an obvious answer. When Perrin started to run to her, Salamander stepped in between. Perrin swung at him flat-handed. All at once, wild folk swarmed into existence and mobbed him, a good 100 of them biting, pinching, kicking, punching, as they fell upon him like dogs on a tossed bone. Perrin screamed and yelped, hitting blindly at an enemy he couldn't see, and finally went down under them, a tossing, heaving mound.
"Enough!" Salamander yelled.
The wild folk disappeared, leaving Perrin trembling and whimpering on the ground.
"That's better, dog!" Salamander snarled. "A fine scion of the wolf clan are you, a horse thief and a wife stealer both."
He flung up one hand and chanted a long string of elvish words under his breath. Suddenly Jill saw a green and grey glow streaming around Perrin. No, it was emanating from him in a cloud of light. From it stretched long smoky tendrils that tangled her round. She suddenly realized that she too stood in a similar cloud, but that hers was pale gold.
"Do you see that, Lord Perrin? Do you see what you've been doing?"
Perrin looked from her to himself and back to Salamander, then suddenly moaned and hid his eyes with his hands. The Girthin said a few more elvish words, then snapped his fingers. A golden sword made of what seemed to be solid light appeared in his hand. He swept it back and forth, slashing at every tendril that bound her to Perrin. The light lines snapped like cut tether ropes and slapped back to him. Perrin screamed, but she felt her mind and her will come back to her, and with them a revulsion, a burning hatred for this man who'd broken her like a wild horse. When Salamander chanted again, the glowing clouds and the sword vanished. Perrin raised his head.
"Don't look at me that way, my love," he whispered. "Oh, by Caron himself, you're not going to leave me, are you?" "Of course I am, you bastard! I never want to see you again in my god-cursed life!" "Jill, I beg you, don't go. I love you. Love.
She felt her hatred burning in her mouth.
I spit on your idea of love.
When Perrin began to weep, the sound was beautiful to her. Salamander looked as if he was thinking of kicking him, then restrained himself.
Listen, you, he snarled. Out of sheer pity, I'll tell you one thing. You've got to stop stealing women and horses this way, or it'll kill you. Do you hear me?
Slowly, Perrin got to his feet to face the Girthin, and his face worked as if he was desperately trying to summon some dignity.
I don't know who you are, he whispered, but I don't have to stay here and have you pour vinegar in my wounds. I can't stop you from taking Jill away, so go. You hear me? Get out.
His voice rose to a shriek.
Go away, both of you.
Then he fell sobbing to his knees again. Very well. Salamander turned to Jill. Let us leave this whimpering dolt to whatever justice the gods have in store for him.
Gladly.
In a swirl of joyous wild folk, they mounted their horses. A big black gnome with purple splotches threw the lead rope of the pack horse up to Salamander, then disappeared as they rode away. Jill glanced back once to see Perrin stretched out on the grass, still weeping in a sea of swelling emerald, with his grey nuzzling his shoulder in concern. Nothing had ever pleased her as much as his pain. For about a mile they rode in silence until they came free of the trees to one of the muddy tracks that passed for a Caergonny road. There Salamander paused his horse, waved at her to do the same, and turned in his saddle to look her over in sincere concern. She could only stare blankly back at him. How do you feel, Jill?
Exhausted.
No doubt, but you'll get your strength back in a bit.
Good. Will the world ever hold still again?
What? What's it doing at the moment?
Well, everything's all... not hazy, exactly, but nothing will hold still. And these colours, everything's so bright and glowy.
She hesitated, struggling with the unfamiliar task of forming sentences.
Nothing has edges, you see. It all sparkles and runs together. And there's no time any more. Wait, that's not right. But it is.
Oh, ye gods, what did that lout do to you?
I don't know.
My apologies, just a rhetorical question. Jill, this is blasted serious.
I could figure that out myself, my thanks. Will I ever see the world like it really is again?
You mean will you ever see it as you used to? Because as for the world as it really is, my turtle dove, that's what you're seeing right now. Before, you've only seen the dull, dead, dark and deceiving surface, as most people do.
But here, these colours and the way everything moves are real enough.
But truly most inconvenient withal. The gods are kind, turtle dove. They let most men see only what they need to see and hide the beauty away.
If they didn't, we'd all starve, because even a simple act like picking an apple from a tree would be a momentous and ominous event.
I can't believe that.
No need for you to believe it, actually. Belief has no bearing whatsoever on your current and most dire condition. Belief is an illusion, and truly all that men see is illusion as well, because the universe is naught but a rushy net of pure power.
That can't be true.
It is, but this is no time for us to argue recondite matters like a pair of bardic sages. That little round-eared bastard has hurt you worse than I feared, Jill.
He paused for a long, troubled silence.
I'm not truly sure what to do about this. Fortunately, our esteemed Nevin will.
Salamander, you're babbling. What did Perrin do to me?
Well, look, you saw those lines of light, didn't you? What he was doing was pouring life force into you, more than you could possibly use or handle. Look, every time you two lay down together, he gave off a tremendous amount of life force. It's not solid like water, but it's more solid than a thought, and it can be transferred back and forth. Normally, whenever a man and woman are together, they each give some out and get some back, all in balance. Now, I doubt me if this truly makes sense to you.
Oh, but it does.
Her disarranged mind was casting up images of Sarkin and Alastair, of the dark Dwayoma that had touched and tainted her life the summer before. For a moment she nearly vomited. When she spoke again, it was only in a whisper.
"Go on. I have to know."
"Well then, summat's wrong with Perrin. He was pouring the force out like mead at a lord's feast, more than you could ever possibly replace in the ordinary course of things. And all that extra power was running free in your mind, free to be used in any way you wished. But since, alas, you had no idea of what to wish for, or indeed that it was even there, then it took the first channel it found to run in, like water again, if we may expand and polish our image, my turtle dove, that escapes from a river only to follow a ditch. You can't lie and say you've no Dwayomer talent, you